Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Helen Schulman about her novel, This Beautiful Life.
Well, I mean, the parents in my book, I think, are too big for their own children.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Linguist Ben Zimmer tells us how all fiction writers sound alike, sort of.
Someone bolting upright or drawing their breath, those particular sort of literary turns of phrase would certainly lend a literary patina to nonfiction as well, written in that style.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. Helen Schulman is one of America's most accomplished and prolific novelists. Her new book is called This Beautiful Life. It's reviewed on our cover by Maria Russo, who says This Beautiful Life is a riveting narrative and that it fiercely inhabits our online reality even as it operates most powerfully on a deeper level, posing enduring questions about American values. I'm delighted that Helen's here to talk about her book. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's a lot to take on. We have a family in Manhattan, kind of upscale, but also living a highly pressurized life.
Absolutely. They've moved recently. They lived in a college town, Ithaca. The husband, Richard, came to take a job in a New York University, and his family followed reluctantly. And now the kids are in high-pressure private schools. It's a mother. His name is Liz. She was a art historian, and now she's a stay-at-home mom. They have a 15-and-a-half-year-old son, Jake, and a 5-year-old daughter, Coco.
Now, this is going to sound familiar to a lot of our listeners. These are the lives many people in New York lead. But serious things happen here that also feel as if they could happen to almost any parent in New York.
Yes, Jake has a big crush on a girl in his school named Audrey, and he goes to a party, and when he sees her go off with another boy, he hooks up with the hostess of the party. No parents are there. The girl's name is Daisy, and she's much younger. She's 13 and a half. Wow. And she's very sexually precocious. She's very desperate and emotionally needy. She's also oddly empowered. They hook up at the party, and when she wants him to spend the night, he kind of publicly humiliates her by saying, no, 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 you're too young. They're all drunk. They're teenagers. And he goes home. But when he gets home the next morning, when he wakes up, there's an email from her, and she has videotaped herself performing a sexual act to a Beyoncé song, Naughty Girl, and sent it to him saying, do you still think I'm too young? It's such a hot potato, he doesn't know what to do with it. He really is a nice kid. And he forwards it to his best friend, who then forwards it to two people. And by the end of the day, it's gone completely viral. And it's not only all over the city, it's all over the country and all over the world. And it just makes the whole community explode.
Helen, there's a story you're telling as well about the aspirations and ambitions of the parents and the life they've chosen for themselves. You live in Manhattan. You've got a couple of kids. Your husband, Bruce Handy, who writes for us all the time, prominent writer and editor in New York. You are too. Is this what's going on in our world today? Things like this?
Well, I think things like this always happen, but not this way. I mean, kids always acted out. It's sort of their job as teenagers to do that. They're experimenting sexually, romantically, passionately. Having good judgment and waiting something out is not what it means to be a teenager. It's always been like that. What's different now is the internet. If a kid makes a mistake, you can't contain it. If a grown-up makes a mistake, if Anthony Weiner makes many, many hideous mistakes, they are uncontainable because the internet, at least at this point, doesn't forget. And it proliferates. And I don't think any of us really, kids or adults, are quite aware truly about that. You know, we all know it, but people continue to make the same errors. I think the other thing was I really was interested not just in the earthquake of the internet on the culture, but post 9/11 American culture. And growing up in New York, I grew up here, being here for 9/11, and then being here through the whole build up to the banking crisis and to the recession, I felt like being at ground zero again and watching all the excess. Also, the fact that people have big guns now. What might have been solved at another time by two fathers beating each other up at a baseball field is suddenly in the courts, in the court of public opinion, in the newspapers, on Gawker, online, and just sort of how big everything is now is maybe not in the best interest of these kids.
Helen, our reviewer Maria Russo praises you for many things, but she thinks one of the smartest decisions you made was to set the novel sometime after 9/11, 2003, I think, but before the implosion in Wall Street. So there's a distinct period in your mind. Was New York a particular kind of place just then?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I did it. And what happens, you know, the father, Richard, in the story is very keenly interested in power. He's also interested in money, and he's also interested in doing good. And the tensions of all those things within him are very complicated, and they overwhelm him. You know, I grew up in the city, and my dad was a doctor. I had a nice middle-class life. I never quite saw the wealth and the greed that I saw when my kids were in private school and in the city, and saw a lot of nice, wealthy people, too. But I do think there was kind of this crazy, we're going to live for today feeling that followed 9/11, and it gave birth to a lot of excess.
Are some of these values or misbegotten values that define the world of adolescence now spring from their own particular world or their surrounding culture, or how much is actually being transmitted by their parents? How much are they, just as children have always been in some way, their parents' children?
Well, I mean, the parents in my book, I think, are too big for their own children. But I think that the culture, and it's not just this moneyed Manhattan culture, it's everywhere, is you do have the threat of the internet. You do have, you know, really sex roles was something I was really interested in, because I was, having grown up in the 70s in the time of feminism, you know, I just remember all my friends' mothers saying to us, you know, you girls have got to take care of yourselves. You have to have your own careers. You have to be independent. And then watching my daughter grow up, and I see all these women who have are fortunate enough to have a choice about working or staying home, and a lot of them choosing to stay home for good reason, right? Because kids need parents, and they, you know, a lot of their husbands were working very, very hard and long hours, but giving up all the work that they had done towards getting various degrees and this great education, and finding that a lot of their power source was in their appearance and holding on to these men who were making a lot of money, you know. So that interested me. I felt like the pressures on young girls now are really different than when I was a kid. I mean, in some ways, it's gone backwards. You know, I remember trying to find bat mitzvah dresses for my daughter when she was going to those parties that didn't look like they were for prostitutes. You know, it was hard. So I think young girls are overly sexualized, and that really comes out in the book.
Helen, what about this specific culture of the exclusive, expensive private school?
I think what happens here in this case in my book is just that these parents have access to everything. So, again, if they want to have a fight with each other, they have lawyers. They have access to the media. They can plant stories. You know, they love their children, and they will do anything to protect them. But again, it's bigger than getting some friends of yours from the bar to go beat up the other guy's dad, which is what I think probably would have happened 30 or 40 years ago.
You're a mom with two children as well as a novelist. At what point do those roles overlap? When are you in situations as a mom where you begin to detach yourself from the situation and think about it or react to it as a writer?
Oh, I think about many things as a writer. This book I thought about as a writer. My children were much younger when I first thought about this book, and it really has had nothing to do with them. But when I am with my children, I am their mother, 100%. So I don't know how to explain that any differently. It's just, I guess it's like what Bill Clinton called compartmentalization.
Thanks a lot, Helen.
Thank you.
That's Helen Shulman, whose new novel, This Beautiful Life, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So a big mystery in the world of publishing.
Yes, there was a mystery book that showed up on Little Brown's fall list. This first came up when bookstore buyers got an email from their sales reps this week being told that they needed to order very quickly. All they were told about the book was that it was called Untitled by Anonymous, and that the book was, quote, the inside story of life with one of the most controversial figures of our time.
Well, that leaves us with a pretty wide field. Do we know any more?
Well, this immediately set off guessing games at bookstores, at Powell's in Portland. The employees started an office pool to guess the subject of the book. At a store in Houston, the owner of the bookstore started a contest of her own, promising the employee who guessed the correct controversial figure a six-pack of beer or a bottle of wine. But we actually do have a few very good clues about who the subject of the book is. According to an employee at Hachette Book Group, of which Little Brown is a division, an internal company database listed two authors of the book, Catherine Hooper and Lori Santel. On the record, Little Brown is making no comment whatsoever, but Catherine Hooper is the fiance of Andrew Madoff, the younger son of Bernie Madoff, who's quite a controversial figure.
So this is a book about Bernie Madoff.
It looks that way.
Wow. I feel as if I already know too much about Bernie Madoff. So this is going to tell us even more, huh? Haven't we heard a lot about him already?
We've heard quite a bit about him, but publishers really can't resist the whole highly orchestrated rollout. They told bookstores that this book will go on sale November 14th, that it's a what they call a one-day laydown, where they're not allowed to put any books on sale before that date. So this is, in a way, just another gimmick to try to build up buzz before a book comes out. And they've also, in their emails to their bookstore buyers, they said that 60 Minutes had already confirmed an appearance by the author.
So all this is very heavily orchestrated and makes me suspect that poor schlubs like my colleagues and I will not see this book one day ahead of time. Is that right?
Probably not, but it looks like due to the chatter of bookstore buyers, their highly orchestrated rollout has been a little bit disrupted.
Now, do we know, just kind of anecdotally, what difference a campaign like this makes? Now, if you have the authors appear on 60 Minutes, that certainly helps sell a book. What about these other things, bookstores and such? If a customer walks in, will he or she be besieged by employees telling them about this exciting new book that's going to come, that's a secret and important and all this?
Probably not. I mean, in independent bookstores, this isn't the kind of book that they're really known for hand selling. But 60 Minutes certainly does sell books, especially with the way that this book is scheduled. You have 60 Minutes on Sunday night, and then the book will go on sale on Monday, which is unusual. Books usually are released on Tuesdays. So we'll probably have a very big first week for this book if there is going to be a lot of sales that'll happen in the first few days, and that's really when they'll get the most buzz.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Readers of the Book Review and auditors of our podcast know that we've introduced a new column. It's called The Mechanic Muse. The author this week is Ben Zimmer. He's written a piece called The Jargon of the Novel, Computer Analysis Reveals the Stylistic Tics Unique to Fiction Writing. Ben's here to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so you raise this idea of what literary language is versus the vernacular and how the two may be entwined.
That's right. I mean, we have a sense these days that literary language is no longer really that literary. When we think of literary language, maybe what comes to mind is Jane Austen or some bygone writer like that, as opposed to, say, American writers in the tradition of Hemingway and so forth. But even though there's been a trend towards vernacularization of the way that novels and short stories are written, nevertheless, we can find out by using these data-driven techniques exactly how fiction remains literary, even if we're not necessarily picking up on the cues as being obviously very high-flying prose.
Okay, so give me some examples.
If you look at a very large collection of texts, and we can do that these days with techniques that are computer-driven. You create an electronic corpus, and then you can break it down into subcorpora. Those are, you know, different slices of that big corpus. And so you can say, okay, let's look at all the fiction that we have in this big collection compared to other texts and tell us, you know, what verbs or what other, you know, interesting words or word combinations show up in fiction much more so than in other genres. As I say in the piece, if you're just looking at verbs, sure, there are, you know, common verbs that are shared across all of these different genres, like saying and coming and going and so forth. Everybody uses that across the board. But if you look at the ones that are used in fiction far more than these other genres, then you get things like grimacing and scowling and grunting and wiggling and gritting and very evocative terms that very often have to do with, say, facial expressions, noises, body movements, all these sorts of things that writers of fiction may focus on and which you're just not going to find in other types of writing.
Okay, Ben, so you mentioned Hemingway. Let's look at him. So this means if we go to those early short stories he wrote, or The Sun Also Rises, where the young Hemingway was so intent on ridding his literary style of anything that looked like artifice, we'll find words like the ones you've mentioned or others similar to that?
Yeah, I mean, even if he was making a very conscious effort to distance himself from earlier literary traditions, there were probably things that we could point to if we look specifically at those that nevertheless set his style apart as being literary. Of course, every writer will have his or her own particular style, but we can see things across the board in terms of word usage when we crunch the numbers and look at all this together.
So words we'd see in Hemingway and maybe other fiction writers, but we're far less likely to see in nonfiction and various other kinds of prose.
That's right. I mean, if you were just comparing newspaper articles to short stories or novels, you'll see these big distinctions. And what Hemingway might have been trying to do would be to rid his writing of things that he saw as artificial in terms of both description and dialogue. But then the actual patterns of the way that words fit together still may remain literary in a way, even if we're not saying, oh, that's just a literary cliche. We can see that there are certain words and then these combinations of words, what linguists call collocations, the way that words come together in particular patterns that still remain distinct for literature.
Now, Ben, we live in an era of what some call creative nonfiction. So we have memoirists and in some cases journalists who also write in a kind of literary style, who often double as literary writers, even going back to a book like In Cold Blood by Truman Capote or some of Norman Mailer's nonfiction. Do we find there that these would actually read more like novels in these terms?
That would be an excellent question for someone in the digital humanities to look at. And I would suspect that, yes, when a writer of nonfiction is trying to be more literary, then we will actually see that in the patterns that show up. So, you know, the types of ways that you describe someone or what they're doing in literature, that might seep into this nonfiction writing as well if they're trying to be more literary. If you talk, for instance, about someone bolting upright or drawing their breath, those particular sort of literary turns of phrase would certainly lend a literary patina to nonfiction as well, written in that style.
Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you.
That's Ben Zimmer, who is the contributor this week to our column, The Mechanic Muse. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this sweltering week?
Well, not a lot of news at the top. George R.R. Martin still rules the fiction list with his A Dance with Dragons. I will be curious to see how long he can keep challengers at bay. There are a few new titles. Daniel Silva is back with his latest art historical thriller. It's called Portrait of a Spy. And Danielle Steele, Did She Ever Really Go Away, is at number 3 with Happy Birthday.
What about the nonfiction list?
J.C. Duggard is still on top with A Stolen Life, her memoir of her years in captivity. Also be interesting to see how long she can hold on to that. Laura Hillenbrand at number 2 with Unbroken. It's her 36th week. Let's count them. No actual new titles, but there's another newish title that's doing pretty well. Laura Ingraham, the conservative pundit firebrand, is at number 6 in her second week with Of Thee I Zing, America's Cultural Decline from Muffin Tops to Body Shots.
Yeah, what's she worked up about?
Well, on the cover of this book, she's sort of dressed up like George Washington and standing on the prow of a boat like she's crossing the Delaware. But she sort of comes off more like Andy Rooney yelling at all the kids to get off her lawn. She sort of is angry about the high-end cupcake craze. I'm kind of with her on that one. You know, bad pickup lines. She sort of rants against so-called lactating daddies. God, I hope none of those guys work here. People who spend too much time on the gaming site Farmville, kids who wear UGG boots, and of course, celebrities who give their kids ridiculous names. She is a little bit late to that party, but she does cite a kind of interesting study that was published a couple years ago in Social Science Quarterly, which suggested that having a kind of unpopular name can predispose a child to a life of crime and incarceration. And the most dangerous names, apparently, are Alec, Ernest, Garland, Ivan, Kareem, Luke, Malcolm, Preston, Terrell, and, wait for it, Walter. Beware the Walters.
Well, that's useful information. Now, Jenny, this week you also write about the extraordinary success of a museum catalog. You don't often see that kind of book on our list.
You don't. And this book is not actually on our list, but it's sort of been a kind of sleeper seller of the past few months. It is the catalog to the exhibit Alexander McQueen's Savage Beauty, which has been at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for a couple months. Alexander McQueen, of course, is the British fashion designer who killed himself last year, very tragically, and was known for these sort of really over-the-top, theatrical, extravagant dresses. I think my favorite one in the catalog of the exhibit is made entirely out of lacquered clamshells, which sounds very clunky and smelly, but it's really sort of extraordinarily elegant. And if I had the money, not to mention the guts, I would wear it tomorrow to work. But anyway, so this exhibit has kind of been a sensation at the Met. They have been packing them in, setting records for attendance. It's helped driven one of the Met's best attendance years in decades. And they've even extended their hours. The show closes next Sunday, August 7th, and the final weekend, it will be open until midnight, which is unprecedented in the museum's history. And if you ask me, it sounds like the ideal premise of a fashion-oriented vampire novel. So anyway, this catalog is on track, according to people at the museum, to sell well over 100,000 copies through museum channels alone. That means in the museum gift shop and on their website. It's also available on Amazon, where it is actually the number one art book. And this is really quite extraordinary for something that, you know, you're not seeing in a lot of regular bookstores.
Well, that's kind of cool, I think.
Well,
is it a beautiful looking book? Have you seen it?
Yeah, the book is beautiful. And the clothes, which, you know, I've only seen pictures of so far, are quite extraordinary. And one thing that's really cool is there's been this real carnival atmosphere at the museum with lots of people dressing up to go, sort of in their real McQueen, if they're rich enough to own it, and or their sort of own ersatz McQueen. Last Friday, one of the sort of hottest day of the year, I was walking in Central Park in the evening, and I saw this band of people in these kind of crazy get-ups walking across the park, and it turned out they were coming from the exhibit.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.